The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Election Day edition of the Georgene Rice Show. Dan Rice, my mother, and I, we filled out our ballots last night, dropped them off at the elections office, and we're, like everyone else, awaiting the outcome. We'll try to share with you some of what to anticipate, although we don't believe there'll be any real numbers until later this evening, long after this program has drawn to a close, and hopefully tomorrow we'll have a better understanding of not only what happened at the top of the ticket with the presidential race, but also some of the down ballot issues here in the state of Oregon, some important ballot measures one may support or not support, but important because it threatens to reshape the way Oregon views a number of issues. And we'll try to cover those for you tomorrow as more information will be available. Well, Oregon voters cast more than 2.15 million votes as of Monday. That crushed the record of 2.05 million votes that was set in the last presidential election in 2016. Well, that development wasn't unexpected. 400,000 more registered voters in Oregon today than 4 years ago contributed to that. And voters surged to vote early this fall with the high-stakes presidential race. Republicans voted in particularly large numbers in Oregon on Monday, turning in 61,400 additional ballots that day compared to 53,100 from Democrats, and narrowed Democrats' turnout advantage. Well, total turnout reached 73%, with Tuesday's voting yet to get underway. Well, as of Monday afternoon, 84.2% of registered Democrats had their ballots logged at their county election headquarters, and that's compared to 81.5% of Republicans. Still, given Democrats' huge registration advantage, Democrats had cast 276,000 more votes statewide than Republicans, nearly 622,000. Unaffiliated voters, they trailed still further with about 505,000 votes logged. Their turnout rate was about 54%, well behind their final turnout in 2016, which reached 61%. Well, voters in Oregon, among other things, are going to decide today whether to decriminalize possession of small amounts of heroin, cocaine, LSD, and other narcotics in a ballot measure in the election. Well, if Measure 110 is approved, instead of being arrested and going to jail, drug users will be able to pay a fine of $100 or go to a free drug rehab center. Tax revenue from retail marijuana sales in Oregon will be used to fund the centers. Measure 110 is backed by the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon chapter of the American College of Physicians, and the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. They say punishing people for drug use and addiction is costly and it hasn't worked. Opponents of the measure include 24 district attorneys who say the measure recklessly decriminalizes possession of the most dangerous types of drugs, and that will lead to an increase in acceptability of dangerous drugs and the damage associated with them. One of the many ballot measures on Oregon's ballot. Well, on the eve of the 2020 election, a group of protesters gathered at Director Park here in Portland for a direct action event. That's what they're called, direct action. Per the governor's orders, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office and the Oregon State Police were working together as a unified command to address potential violence. A group of protesters left Director Park at about 9 p.m. They headed for the Portland State University campus. Protesters threw rocks. They smashed windows at the campus, including at the university's Kramer Hall and Smith Memorial Student Union, and at Starbucks located on the ground floor of an apartment building on the Southwest Montgomery Street. Well, around 9:15, Unified Command declared an unlawful assembly. They ordered the crowd to disperse. The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office said that officers interrupted a possible arson attempt when they said some individuals in the group poured flammable liquid inside the Starbucks. Now, this is beneath an apartment building. Keep that in mind. At or around 10 p.m., the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office said at least two people had been arrested. A tire iron, dumbbell, body armor, gas masks, and an umbrella from individuals in the group were collected. The group eventually left the area. And so it continues. Well, a collection of groups led by Black Lives Matter and shut down D.C. reportedly have been holding training sessions for demonstrations to protest today. And apparently they're planning a large-scale event across the street from the White House, expected to draw thousands. Several leaked documents and Zoom call recordings described a loose but coordinated network of activists seeking to mobilize around the country, especially if Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden loses or if President Donald Trump contests the election results. Now, the materials purportedly showed plans to shut down federal buildings, including the White House, and to meet members of Congress at public transportation portals when they're scheduled to reconvene in Washington after the election. The apparent goal is to continue the civil unrest from Election Day until at least later this week and potentially until the presidential inauguration in January. So my advice, gird your loins. Well, many young Americans seem to have a growing disdain for our country. According to a Gallup poll, pride in our nation has declined, especially among young adults. Now, young adults are taking to the streets and not merely protesting, but wreaking havoc in many cases, rioting and looting, tearing down statues, shutting down anyone who doesn't share their perspective. Now, one reason this is happening is what our children are being taught in school. And that doesn't mean only in college. We all know college campuses have become centers of radical indoctrination. But now it's happening in K through 12 as well, through something called Action Civics, a new movement in civic education. Well, as educator Thomas Lindsay explains, Action Civics was born in 2010 when six organizations set out to redefine civic education. Dissatisfied with traditional civics, which depended on book learning, they wanted to create a new civics that were only experimental. They wanted kids to engage, get involved, get active. Well, the problem is that without a solid understanding of why the founders were so deliberate in designing our self-government republic, with its separation of powers to prevent any one branch from becoming tyrannical, or establishing the rule of law so that we would not be subject to the whims of any one person, we risk falling into the same traps of other less just regimes. Indeed, it's no accident that today's protests are looking more like the French Revolution with its guillotines and beheadings than the American Revolution with its debates and deliberations. Robert Pondisco himself, once a proponent and teacher of Action Civics, wrote that it has grown into a manipulative and cynical use of children as political props in the service of causes they understand superficially, if at all. Well, indeed, a study published by the National Association of Scholars found that Action Civics projects essentially teach students to protest for progressive political causes. Peter Wood, president of the National Association of Scholars, pointed out the new civics is, in fact, a form of anti-civics. It doesn't teach students how our government works or, even more importantly, their critical role as citizens in a self-governing republic. Rather, it simply teaches them how to be activists. Well, for many today, it feels as if our country never has been more divided and the ideals of the founders never more at risk. That's due in a small part, well, no small part, to what's being taught in school. Parents have to step up to take a more active role in their children's education, carefully watching what their kids are being taught or not taught in this case. The good news is that with the COVID-19 crisis and the prevalence of online learning, it's easier than ever that for parents to actually keep an eye on what's being taught to their children. But what parents do with the information is what really matters. They need to engage with schools, school boards, teachers, and principals to ensure that students are taught more than simply how to protest. And one can only hope that will be the case. Well, some of the headlines I woke to this morning: voting machines stopped working in Georgia County on Election Day. Computerized voting machines have stopped working at all polling locations in a county in Georgia, officials reported on Election Day. Another headline: Ohio, Franklin County using backup system to check in voters after technical problems. Ohio's Franklin County, the most populous one in the state, switched to paper poll books after they experienced technical problems. Another headline: Pelosi, Congress prepared to decide on presidential election if disputed. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told NPR on Monday that Congress is ready to decide on the presidential election. There's a big if after that. And a Texas judge rejected a bid to toss 127,000 drive-through ballots in Harris County, Texas. Well, the Texas district judge rejected a GOP-led bid to toss those 127,000 drive-through ballots in Harris County, which includes Houston. Just some of the headlines. Well, Trump or Biden, America is heading to the polls, wondering when the final result will be known. We'll talk about that and much more when we return in just a few moments. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. And I should mention later in the second hour of today's program, we're going to talk with Tara and Jeff Mattson. Their latest book, Shrinking the Integrity Gap Between What Leaders Preach and Live, an excellent resource I would recommend to anyone who has any capacity of influence or leadership. They're coming up in our next hour. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, Trump or Biden? Americans have headed to the polls. They've voted early, and we're all wondering what the final result will be and when it will be known. Voters will cast their ballots nationwide today to choose whether the next president of the United States will be Donald Trump or Joe Biden, even as tens of millions have already voted either early or through the mail. Well, by the time the polls close, the presidential election cycle that began more than 3 years ago in July of 2017, when former Representative John Delaney of Maryland declared that he was running for the Democratic nomination, will draw to a close. Well, sort of. In 2020, many states, including key swing states, may count their votes more slowly than during typical years. There are also cases, such as in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, where elections boards will count ballots that are mailed on or before Election Day, but are received days later. Pennsylvania will accept ballots for up to 3 days after Election Day, and North Carolina will accept ballots for 9 days. States that take longer to count their mail votes are likely to see vote counts that favor Trump early on Tuesday night as in-person totals come in, and then a swing toward Biden later in the evening and potentially in the following days. Well, some wonder if the 2020 election could come down to one county. Well, we'll have to see. Howard Kurtz points out that the media may face premature victory claims in this powder keg election, but patience must rule the day. Senator Kennedy calls Trump an insult to the political elite, who never talks down to the working class. And a Pennsylvania bakery's election-themed cookie poll is now showing a clear front runner. And no, I'm not going to tell you who it is. Well, former Vice President Biden has brought his anti-fracking activist Lady Gaga to his Pennsylvania rally yesterday, drawing Trump campaign criticism and those from rural areas believing they had been mocked. And Trump warns Americans that Biden's far-left supporters may loot and rob if they don't like the election outcomes. President Trump opened his second-to-last ever rally for the presidency by touting his law and order message in Kenosha, Wisconsin on Monday night. He said Democrats were waging war on our police as a back the blue chant broke out among the crowd. Well, the president then took aim at Joe Biden, warning that the Democratic presidential nominee was beholden to the progressive wing of the party, a faction that threatened to cause destruction in U.S. cities if the election outcome is not to their liking. Well, the truth is, many have said it doesn't matter which way it goes, they still intend to disrupt. Biden's far-left supporters, the president said, are threatening to loot and rob tomorrow if they don't get their way. Rioting, looting, and arson will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. I'm telling you that right now. Well, earlier in the day, he warned a crowd in Pennsylvania that Biden posed a threat to the state's energy industry. A vote for Biden will be a vote for to ban fracking, outlaw mining, explode energy costs, and destroy Pennsylvania, the president said, Pennsylvania being a critical state in this election. Well, he also said the Supreme Court decision on Pennsylvania ballots is dangerous and will induce violence. And pro-Trump Trump voters held their final San Diego Bay parade before the election day. While stars are rallying behind Joe Biden, but Donald Trump matches celebrity cash thanks to one showbiz leader. Democrat Joe Biden's record-breaking fundraising haul was aided by broad support from celebrities who poured in at least $13.1 million into boosting his White House bid. Roughly 6,165 people involved in show business and professional sports rallied behind the former vice president by donating to Biden's presidential campaign and pro-Biden political action committees. That's according to campaign finance data compiled by the Center for Responsive Politics. In comparison, roughly 525 people in the entertainment world donated money to help re-elect President Trump, the donor data said, through the 14th of October. And while Trump, the former reality TV star, had far fewer celebrity backing for his re-election efforts, he matched Biden's celebrity donor total of about $13 million thanks to one wealthy entertainment leader. Ike Perlmutter, he's the chairman of Marvel Entertainment, which produces action hero movies, gave a pro-Trump super PAC $10.5 million in September to help boost Trump's efforts to win a second term. Perlmutter, a billionaire Israeli-American executive, lists Palm Beach County in Florida as his address and has wielded influence with Trump as a pal and member of the president's Mar-a-Lago Club, according to ProPublica. He donated to the pro-Trump America First Action Group. In total, data obtained tracking $26.3 million in donations from nearly 6,700 individuals who listed an occupation related to show business or professional sports, who gave to Trump or Biden's presidential campaign or other groups supporting them. Well, as I mentioned, Lady Gaga's pro-Biden video was hit with hit four, mocking rural Americans. John Voight slammed Biden, saying Trump must win the election. Well, we'll have to decide what the voters decide. Pennsylvania Attorney General was hit for predicting Trump will lose the election before votes were even counted. Of course, lots of people are predicting these days. Hannity says Democrats are in a full-fledged panic after Trump's barnstorming swings through states to massive crowds. And California police are seeking a shirtless man and a bikini-clad woman after an American flag and a hat were snatched from Trump supporter in their vehicle. California's ballot initiative on gig workers could be among the costliest in that state's history, and a Trump or Biden election potential impact has 44% of business executives worried for their organizations. Facebook and Twitter plan to label candidate posts declaring premature victory on the election on Election Day, and Walmart has abandoned their shelf-scanning robots in favor of letting actual humans work. Well, Election Day polls show a tight race in key states. I guess that's not really news. ABC News claims the Trump campaign needs the polls, virtually all of them, to be wrong. The truth is, just a few need to be off by a little. According to the 538 collection of polls, Trump is down but within the margin of error in North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Florida. All he needs is to close those races and beat the Pennsylvania average, which is still under 5%. The Real Clear Politics average of polls has it even closer, with Trump leading in Iowa, Ohio, North Carolina, and Georgia, while slightly down but inside the margin of error in Florida, Arizona, and Pennsylvania. Clinton had a 4-point lead in Pennsylvania in 2016. The 2016 state-by-state polling averages can be instructive, but of course, things have changed. Well, a look at Biden's recent unpresidential comments. Town Hall has a list of them, suggesting that that's proof positive he's not ready for the White House. Sports analyst Clay Travis says there are staggering numbers of people in sports media who are voting for Trump but are afraid to admit it, which is also the case for many Americans around the country. He says, as can I change my vote trends on Google, the answer depends on the state. It's not easy a thing to pull off. Of course, today's election day, so the answer probably now is no. William McGurn features pollster Matt Towery, one of the very few who got 2016 right and who believes Trump is going to do it again. Again, we'll see what happens. Nick Traynor, the Trump campaign's director of battleground strategy, breaks down why he believes today will be a huge win for his boss. He looks at the Biden early voting advantage in key states that have evaporated over the past 2 weeks and what they expect from Trump voters today in the Washington Examiner. By the way, Salem is going to cover the election through the entire evening, beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's 3 p.m. Pacific time, with Hugh Hewitt and most of our syndicated hosts. Something to keep in mind. Well, violence in Chicago reveals police are being targeted at a startling race. Statistics from the Chicago Police Department released on Sunday and reported by the Chicago Sun-Times show 67 officers have been shot at, with 10 of them struck by bullets. The uptick is four times more than last year, when 17 officers were shot at, two being struck by gunfire. And California retailers are folding as the state legalizes shoplifting. Well, the story notes, due to laws enacted by progressives, shoplifting has essentially been decriminalized, and retailers that apprehend thieves can be sued. So as groups of shoplifters enter the stores, the often verbally abused clerks must stand back and allow it. Well, 9 in 10 Portland rioters have seen their charges dropped, and it turns out most of them are Portland residents, not outsiders, as some would like to believe. And Michigan requires restaurants to get the names and telephone numbers of their customers. So like they do in China, they can trace you. Well, today, of course, is Election Day. Trump would be the first president to lose while polling favorably on the economy if he doesn't prevail. And Biden has lost his clear favored status from Nate Silver's 538 at the last minute. And of course, that's based on polling numbers. Pelosi says the House is prepared to pick the president if need be. She said it with a grin. And even if Republicans lose the majority, The difference between 50 and 51 Democrat senators could be huge. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show on this election day. Hope you're spending part of it on your knees. We need a little supernatural help. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Just want to remind you, coming up in the 5 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Tara and Jeff Mattson. They've written a brilliant book, Shrinking the Integrity Gap Between What Leaders Preach and Live. It may not be what you expect. It's written from a very practical standpoint that gets really to the core of an individual who is in a position of leadership, whether that's an official titled position or one in which you just inherit by virtue of being a parent or a person of influence. That's coming up at 5 o'clock. Well, social media has censored a Trump tweet knocking the Supreme Court's Pennsylvania decision. They've been very busy censoring these days. Police say a Biden-Harris vehicle was likely at fault in the Trump train incident. Maybe you're familiar with that. You can read more about it on the Daily Wire if you'd like. U.S. manufacturing is accelerated to a near two-year high, and two major mall owners have filed for bankruptcy, citing rent losses. 2020 set an all-time gun sales record, even while Joe Biden and Kamala Harris want to destroy the Second Amendment. By the way, gun ownership among African Americans has skyrocketed. A suspect timing? Well, a judge has blocked the Trump administration's immigration rule on public benefits, and NATO allies have spent $50 billion more on defense thanks to Trump's hardball response. And the U.S. is seizing the largest ever shipment of fuel and weapons from Iran. Well, activists on the left plan unrest in D.C. and elsewhere, and anti-capitalist rioters smashed windows of businesses during a violent Portland march, both yesterday, last night, and the night before. Oakland's move to defund police inevitably has been met with a spike in homicides, and a judge has rejected a GOP bid to toss 127,000 drive-through ballots in Harris County, Texas. 13,000 Florida felons could boost Biden after celebrities paid about $27 million in fines and fees for the privilege. And if you thought Halloween was over, dead people have been caught voting in New York City. Well, a judge has limited Governor Newsom's powers during the coronavirus pandemic, and several celebrities say they'll leave America if President Trump is reelected. Of course, many of the same celebrities made similar promises in 2016 that they didn't keep. A Florida fisherman creeps up on and harpoons a whopping 13-foot, 1,000-pound alligator he says stalked him for years. She's on the other foot now. And four are dead, 17 were injured in a Vienna Islamist attack. Supreme Court has rejected a qualified immunity defense for the first time in years. And the Supreme Court sides with Black Lives Matter activists over an injured police officer. Taking a look at this day in history, 1839, the first opium war between China and Britain breaks out. 1911, the Chevrolet Motor Company is founded in Detroit by Louis Chevrolet and William Durant. The company would be acquired by General Motors in 1918. 1936, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt wins a landslide election victory over Republican challenger Alfred Alf Landon. 1957, the Soviet Union launches Sputnik 2, the second man-made satellite into orbit. On board is a dog named Laika, who would be sacrificed in the experiment. On this day in history, 1964, President Lyndon Baines Johnson soundly defeats Republican Barry Goldwater to win a White House term in his own right. 1992, Democrat Bill Clinton is elected the 42nd president of the United States, defeating President George Herbert Walker Bush. 1992, in Illinois, Democrat Carol Moseley Brown, she becomes the first black woman to be elected to the United States Senate, defeating Republican Richard Williamson. And on this day in history, 1997, the Supreme Court let stand California's groundbreaking Proposition 209, which bans race and gender preference in hiring and school admissions. 2014, 13 years after the 9/11 terrorist attack, the resurrected World Trade Center opens for business, marking an emotional milestone for both New Yorkers and the nation. Finally, on this day in history, 2017, Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who walked away from his post in Afghanistan and triggered a search that left some of his comrades severely wounded, is spared a prison sentence by a military judge in North Carolina. President Trump blasts that decision as a complete and total disgrace. Well, as we all know, voters are casting their ballots nationwide today to choose whether the next president of the United States will be Donald Trump or Joe Biden, among other things, by the way, even as tens of millions have already voted either early or through the mail. Well, some things to consider during this election day as Americans choose their next president, their senators, and so on. Battleground states. Every election year has so-called battleground states, and their importance comes to the forefront because most states assign their electoral college votes on a winner-take-all basis. That means states that are reliably red, like Oklahoma, or reliably blue, like California, are considered baked into each candidate's path to victory. Therefore, the candidate focus their time and their efforts on politically moderate states that could swing for one candidate or the other and make it more likely to put them over that 270 electoral vote mark to secure the White House. Well, this year, perhaps the most important battleground state is Pennsylvania, which provides a meaty 20 electoral votes and could provide an early indication of whether other Rust Belt states will swing for Trump or for Biden. If Trump can notch a win there, and by extension, potentially Michigan or Wisconsin, it would put him on a very strong path to a second term. Meanwhile, a win for Biden in Pennsylvania almost certainly forecloses Trump a path to victory. In fact, because more states are likely in Biden camp, according to the polls, Trump will likely need to run the table with a large number of battleground states in order to be victorious. So if you're a Trump supporter, that's what you want to be looking for. Well, for that matter, either way. That includes Texas, which after a very long time is a solidly Republican state, has become more purple in recent years. Ohio is a longtime swing state that no Republican has ever won the presidency without. And Florida, which along with Ohio, has long been one of the most important states in the presidential election. Now, states that are more important and to Biden's path to victory include Michigan and Wisconsin, as well as Minnesota, which Trump narrowly lost in 2016, and Nevada. Georgia, Arizona, and North Carolina, as well as a handful of other moderate states, also figure to potentially play an important role on Tuesday night, depending on the Electoral College scenario. Well, the first states to have their all polls close will come at 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern time in Georgia, Indiana, Kentucky, South Carolina, Vermont, and Virginia. Kentucky and Indiana will have some polls close in the eastern time parts of the state at 6 p.m. The last polls of the night will close at 1 a.m. Eastern time in Alaska. Now, Georgia is the only battleground state that's going to see all of its polls close at 7 p.m. Pacific time, or rather Eastern time, but it's going to be followed by a flurry of other critical states. Florida's polls close at 7 p.m. local time, which means full state results from the state will not begin to feed in until 8 p.m. Eastern time, as part of Florida is in the central time zone. Polls in North Carolina and Ohio, they close at 7:30 Eastern time. Maine, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania close their polls at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Texas closes its polls at 7 p.m. local time, which means in most of the state's polls, they're going to close at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Some of the far western parts of Texas are in mountain time, and we're going to see their polls close at 9 p.m. Eastern time. All polls in Florida will be closed by 8 p.m. Eastern time. Well, Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, Minnesota, Wisconsin, they all close at 9 p.m. Eastern time, and all polls in Texas will be closed by that time as well. Iowa and Nevada close their polls at 10 p.m. Eastern time. It's going to be either a long night or a long following day and a long week, perhaps. Well, with warnings that the time-consuming process of counting mail ballots could take days in some states and plans by some states to accept ballots that are sent by Election Day but received days later, Trump has demanded a final total on November 3rd. Not going to happen. But it's not clear that will be the case because of how states count their ballots and how media organizations decide to call those races. Well, most states in the past have been able to count the vast majority of their ballots on the night of the election after the polls close. But in almost all states, it takes days or even more for every ballot to be counted and the race results to be certified and official. So it will be a long haul. We may have a sense of the outcome, but don't get too excited because things could change when you have ballots coming in days after Election Day. So it could swing one way or another. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, and it's going to be an interesting season for these last few days. One of the things that Victor Davis Hanson points out is the 2020 election isn't really about a choice between the individuals, Donald Trump and Joe Biden. It really has more to do with the the worldview, the direction that each of these candidates wants to take the country, and for that matter, the parties want to take the country. We'll touch on that in just a moment, but do need to take a quick break. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Coming up at the top of the next hour, we'll talk with Tara and Jeff Mattson, shrinking the integrity gap between what leaders preach and live. That's coming up at 5. Well, even if Republicans lose the majority, difference between 50 and 51 Democratic senators could be huge. Well, as Election Day has finally arrived, the polls show Republicans still have a decent shot at holding on to the Senate. While the 538 forecast gives President Trump just a 1 in 10 chance of winning re-election, the polling analytics website gives Republicans a 1 in 4 chance of controlling the Senate. Or maintaining control. Even if Republicans can't hold 51 seats, they have a fairly decent chance of limiting the damage to a 50-50 Senate that would make it more difficult for Democrats to enact some of their more radical plans, from abolishing the filibuster to funding elective abortions with taxpayer dollars. Now look at where the battle for the Senate stands. The Senate is controlled 53-47 by Republicans. The GOP is very likely to pick up a seat in Alabama, but Democrats are very likely to pick up a seat in Colorado. So Democrats would look to Arizona, Maine, North Carolina as their next best opportunities to pick up 3 more seats in order to have control of the Senate if the Biden-Harris ticket wins the presidential race. In Arizona, Republican Senator Martha McSally, she trails Democrat Mark Kelly by 5.8 points. That's 44.5% to 50.3% in the Real Clear Politics average of polls. In North Carolina, Republican Senator Tom Tillis trails Democrat Cal Cunningham by 2.2 points in the RCP polling average. And in Maine, they haven't produced an average of polls, but Maine Senator Susan Collins has trailed Democrat Sarah Gideon by 2 to 3 points in 3 recent surveys. Now, she, of course, is the incumbent. In 8 congressional election cycles dating back to 2004, there is only 1 Senate race in which a candidate won despite trailing by more than 3 percentage points in the Real Clear Politics polling average on Election Day. But there are many examples of Senate candidates who still won despite trailing by 3 points or less in that polling average on Election Day. So it'll be an interesting race to watch. So it would not be all that surprising to see Tillis or Collins hold their seats. A McSally upset would be shocking, but not unthinkable. The presidential race in Arizona is much closer than the Senate race. And McSally's hope, rather, is that Trump wins and she carries the victory on his coattails. Well, one thing that makes Maine tough for Collins is the state's ranked choice voting system. Ranked choice voting means that third party voters are reallocated to their votes, their voters' second and third choice, if no candidate gets an outright majority. Republican strategists believe that Collins will need to be at about 48% of election night if she's going to survive a final allocation of Green Party votes. So they're allocating those that didn't vote Republican or Democrat. If Republicans are going to have a Senate majority in 2021, they need to hold on to one of these 2 seats and run the table everywhere else. They're playing defense, and the outlook is fairly good that they could do just that, but it's by no means certain. In Georgia, Republicans have 2 Senate seats to defend, but both races are expected right now to head to a January 5th runoff. The only question for Republicans is whether Democrat John Ossoff might hit 50% on Election Day and win outright in his head-to-head race against Republican Senator David Perdue. That seems unlikely. Ossoff leads Perdue 47% to 46.3% in the latest average poll. So those are just some of the things to mention. There's Montana, the race in Kansas and Alaska, South Carolina. And again, the big prize this time around would be the flipping of the Senate on the part of the Democrats, and maintaining the control of the House for the Democrats is another prize that they plan on and hope to retain. Well, just days before Election Day, the president signed an executive order to push patriotic education by establishing the federal 1776 Commission. He wrote on the eve of Election Day, just signed an order to establish the commission. We'll stop the radical indoctrination of our students and restore patriotic education to our schools. The president made reference to the executive order during his rally in Scranton, Pennsylvania on Monday. I just signed that executive order to teach your students pro-American values. Well, the president announced the idea of the Education Commission in September after attempts to remove statues of some American revolutionaries and colonial figures in the midst of riots sparked by the death of George Floyd in May. Well, according to the details of this executive order, they published on the White House's website on Monday, the Trump administration noted that recent attacks on our founding have highlighted America's history related to race, adding that they are filled with one-sided and divisive rhetoric that ignore or fail to properly honor and recollect the great legacy of the American national experience, our country's valiant and successful effort to shake off the curse of slavery and to use the lessons of that struggle to guide our work toward equal rights for all citizens in the present. Again, signed by the president yesterday. Well, as winter encroaches, more than half of U.S. consumers are considering replenishing their assortment of goods and essential products that they had originally stockpiled during the onset of the coronavirus pandemic earlier this year. That's according to new research from data-driven technology-enabled service company Inmar Intelligence. When the pandemic hit the U.S. in March, 64% of shoppers created a stockpile of products as a result, according to the group. Now, roughly 57% of shoppers are considering restocking due to growing fears of a potential second wave of COVID-19, which could lead to another round of bare store shelves. Over a quarter of shoppers, roughly 27%, are considering revamping their winter stockpile due to concerns that certain products won't be in stock when they need them. Meanwhile, another 27% are more concerned about the safety of in-store shopping if a second wave were to occur. And we learned yesterday that a percentage of store clerks had COVID-19 without symptoms while serving the public. Hygiene products topped shoppers' stockpile list again, with 67% grabbing toilet paper, 57% searching for hand sanitizer, both of which were in high demand in the early stage of the pandemic. Now you can find it everywhere. It left store shelves empty then, online retailers charging sky-high prices then, and people are concerned that might happen again. Canned goods, 54%, disinfecting wipes at 53%, paper towels, 52%, are also products that consumers have stocked up on or plan to stock up on for the upcoming season. Well, unlike their first stockpile, about 47% of shoppers, they plan to invest in new items such as frozen dinners, pasta, snacks, and cleaning products. So they're broadening their perspective. Overall, about 55% of shoppers are planning to purchase goods in store, suggesting that brick and mortar retailers are still crucial for consumers when purchasing everyday items. Inmar, the CEO of the organization, said that during this time of heightened concern, shoppers will look to their local retailers to deliver consistency and seamless customer service, especially at the busy shopping season arrives. Of course, we're just looking ahead toward Thanksgiving, whatever that may ultimately be, and then Christmas. It's going to be important for retailers not only to prepare for this new surge in demand, but also deliver value to customers during this time of crisis in order to maintain heightened trust and customer loyalty. But it's not yet clear when, if ever, buyers' habits will get back to normal, whatever normal will ultimately one day be. Even when the pandemic subsides, about 54% of shoppers plan to keep a stockpile of goods due to fear of another emergency. So interesting that we're seeing that mentality reemerge. Another headline, American shoppers panic buying as coronavirus spike aggravates year of upheaval. Holiday retail sales are off to a fantastic start, former Toys R Us CEO says. So there are other areas as well. The former CEO says that the provided some insight into Amazon's Prime Day consolidation in retail in the holiday shopping season. I think a lot of people took advantage of that that day to do some of their Christmas shopping. Well, coming up, I'm so looking forward to a conversation with Tara and Jeff Madsen. They are local, as you probably know, and their latest book is Shrinking the Integrity Gap Between What Leaders Preach and Live. Now, whether or not you consider yourself an official leader, all of us have some level of influence. And this is an excellent book on integrity in general. It's specifically written for those who are in positions of leadership, either recognized or by default. But it offers some great insight into how to live a life of integrity. So they're going to be joining me up in our next segment here at the top of the hour. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. News and traffic up next.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show, and I've been looking forward to the conversation we're just about to have on a new book titled Shrinking the Integrity Gap Between What Leaders Preach and Live. The book is written by Jeff and Tara Mattson, and I'm excited to have this conversation. I think it's particularly poignant right now, but you might think that this is limited only to those who have positions that have titles associated with them, but they make the point that all of us, or many of us, most of us perhaps, have in some way a position of leadership. They write about the book that every good leader wants to learn to grow and serve more effectively, and we especially want to align the values we preach with the values we live out. But in the busyness and the realities of leadership, it's hard to know where to start. Well, this book is very practical, not only explaining where to start, but how to establish the very pattern that we're talking about today. So I'm looking forward to our conversation. My guests are the founders of Living Wholehearted, Jeff Mattson and Tara Mattson, are leaders, helping leaders understand how much our personal histories influence our leadership, for better or for worse. And in this new book, in Shrinking the Integrity Gap, they provide long-term solutions rooted in grace and developed from research as they explore how to do a number of things, including closing that gap between our intentions and our actions, processing pain from the past that impacts the present, how to turn weakness into strengths, and much, much more. Well, we are just delighted to have you with us, Tara and Jeff Mattson. Welcome.
Thank you for having us, Georgene.
Yes, thank you, Georgene.
This is such an important book, and as I mentioned earlier, I think it really applies to more of us than would necessarily think we are in a position of leadership. To whom is your book written, so that our listeners know, is this something that I might benefit by?
Absolutely. We believe that if you have a following, you're a leader. So if you are a parent leading the family, the most important organization on the planet from our worldview, you are a leader, and all the way up to if you're leading a Fortune 500 company and everybody in between, small group leaders, pastors, anybody who is influencing on social media, if people are watching you, you are a leader, Georgene.
In your introduction, you quote Parker Palmer, and I appreciated this so much. It's from Leading from Within. A leader is a person who must take special responsibility for what's going on inside him or herself, inside his or her conscience, lest the act of leadership create more harm than good. This book is not just about how leadership styles that are successful. You are really going to the root. You're looking at what the interior life of a leader is to avoid that gap between what we proclaim and how we actually live.
Yeah, that's true. We really believe that both character and competencies are critical for leaders. And we do work with a lot of leaders who are leading their organizations and leading the masses. And, you know, we've got a history with working in their family systems and as in marriages and as individuals, and with their business and nonprofit organizational teams and such, and it's just so important to have both growth in character and in competencies. And it's a journey, and living and leading with integrity is not an event. It's an everyday lifestyle. It's a choice that we make multiple times throughout every day. There's ebbs and flows, highs and lows in that, and it's really a commitment we have over a lifetime.
And we say that we really want to look at that inner life, the things that are going on that we don't have time to often look at. And so that's really what this book is going after, less about the fruit of our lives and more about the roots, as you were saying.
Now, you write that integrity is highly valued but rarely lived out. Let's begin by defining what integrity is and why we struggle to meet the standard we set for ourselves.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, integrity really is, there's lots of definitions that are out there and lots of books have been written about it. We really think it has to do with really being a wholehearted person, a wholehearted leader, if you will. And that is where every part of your life, all your relationships, the decisions, the choices, the way you communicate, how you live, all of these aspects of a person's life are moving in a singular, and from our hope and prayers from a biblical worldview, moving in a singular direction, a God-orientated direction. And that does not mean perfection. Only Christ didn't have what we call the integrity gap. that distance between what we preach and live. I mean, he's the only one. That means that every one of us is working, has an integrity gap, and it's a noble pursuit, especially as a follower of Christ, to be shrinking that down and with the Holy Spirit's help. In order to be able to practice what essentially what we preach or live what we espouse and preach in our lives, no matter where you're coming from, we have to be intentional about shrinking that down. Otherwise, if we're not, our gap is growing, and everybody in our wake is either benefiting from us closing our gap in our life, or everyone's going to pay. It's just a matter of time if that gap is widening.
You make the point that the goal is for a leader to know who they are, to understand their own stories, their wiring, and their limitations, and that's a good place to begin. But you really expose some of the areas in which leaders tend to retreat based on a variety of reasons in order to continue to lead perhaps very well, but to see a divergence between what's being preached and encouraged in others, but not necessarily lived out in the life of the individual. What are some of the symptoms of integrity gaps?
Yeah, we start with one of the bigger ones that we see in high-capacity leaders more often is the idea that they are trauma survivors. I should say we. I mean, even Jeff and I, looking at our own stories, oftentimes trauma produces either a debilitating victimization or we become overperformers. And our achievements become a way of hiding. And oftentimes we get praised and moved along the leadership treadmill until all of a sudden we find ourselves way down the line and have never really had a chance to process our stories, to grieve the pain of what's happened. And when I say trauma, I really am meaning anything out of the ordinary, from divorce to extensive moving, to all kinds of things that we talk about right now in terms of microaggressive racism. We would talk also about the bigger stuff, sex abuse, emotional abuse, a wide variety of spiritual abuse that happens in a lot of leaders' lives. And the more that that gets shoved to the side, the more that that ends up having maladaptive coping strategies, they start to show up in our life, and we find ourselves dealing with a lot of loneliness, arrogance. We talk about narcissism, not willing to have compassion for other people's stories because we can't even deal with our own pain. And that is really kind of the more deeper trenches of what we're calling the integrity gap, these places that are blind spots and we keep ignoring and compartmentalizing and are leaking in our leadership.
These are just some of the things, the symptoms that we'd say that leaders really are vulnerable to. And that's what we're writing to here. We're writing to the symptoms that no matter where you are in your leadership journey, if you're on the earlier end of that as an emerging leader, you're surely going to see and experience some of these along the journey the longer you go. Seasoned leaders can identify all of these symptoms and understand how they feel and maybe have lived several of them already. But it's to say... What can you do about it? How can you know that this is likely coming, and how can we be less vulnerable to falling into these symptoms? And that's where the antidotes come in, they providing practical helps and just vision ahead, especially for younger leaders. And so, you know, the tendency, as Tara described, for maladaptive coping strategies, I mean, others that aren't that we go into are escapism and compartmentalization. As the pressures mount in as a leader, to isolate is common. It's not good or healthy, but that then leads to that desire to escape pain. And you know, you might be incredibly successful in your workplace, but gosh, don't feel welcomed at home, or your family doesn't want to welcome you at home, right? So this escapism is a temptation, and then we compartmentalize. You know, and that's such a huge tendency, and in many cases has been so promoted in the world and in the church, is this idea of, you know, your work life, your home life, and we even say these things as if that exists, when the reality is that you bring all of who you are wherever you go.
You know, we're all familiar with the fallout from individuals failing to live and lead with integrity. Is this lack of self-awareness, is this common in us? And how is it that we find so many leaders in a position where there's a disconnect between these traumas or triggers that have impacted the way leadership is undertaken?
Well, there's many factors that are playing a role. We've shifted as a culture drastically over the years, and we can pinpoint kind of where that happened. But we've shifted from character mattering in leadership to mm-hmm. charisma and talents and, you know, achievement quick. And those are impacting that, adding to the division that happens in our lives. You know, nothing good happens fast. And so we're really calling for a slow and steady drip of really looking at our stories and our pain. And so both systemically, how we are progressing leaders, we're kind of pushing them along the line of leadership too quickly. Mm-hmm. Again, just applauding the performance rather than really knowing who a person is. We're also good at not taking care of when people are honest about their struggles. We just toss them to the side and move on. And so we're calling, especially the church, to say, hey, we've got to have better systems in place when somebody is struggling and needing to be honest, because that is integrous. When you can say, I'm struggling, I'm noticing these things in my life, and I'm having a harder time being able to move through the pain of what's ever happening, whether it's my inner thought life or I'm actually acting out in some behaviors. But our goal and our hope is that both individually as leaders and as a community, we will start to really value who we are as people and less about what we do, and really caring about our soul care, our mind care, our emotional care, our relationship care, in addition to what we get done off our checklist at the end of the day.
We're talking this afternoon about the new book, Shrinking the Integrity Gap, that helps leaders to identify those areas where they're struggling and the importance of tracing back to the early days some of the things that may influence the way we lead others. Jeff and Tara Mattson are my guests. We're going to continue our conversation in a moment, but I do need to take a quick break, so stay with us. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show, talking with Jeff and Tara Mattson. Their latest book, Shrinking the Integrity Gap Between What Leaders Preach and Live. And this is such a touchy area for many, because you might find yourself in the middle of a leadership role and feel completely vulnerable and unable to admit or at least expose some of those areas where you're struggling. Now, when you identify, you know, there are traumas and triggers in the past that are revealing themselves in the way that you lead. How do we identify what's going on in terms of my leadership style and how that history is impacting how I'm leading?
Well, one of the ways we can just tell you how it began to happen for me is through that the reality of ambivalence. So much in my story took time to try to discern and understand what was going on. And ambivalence is really having the positive and a negative feeling about the same thing, the same person, same event at the same time. You know, and I come from a home that was a broken home, and that was some early example of trauma. And some, even as I say that, some listeners might go, well, what's that? I mean, aren't over half of homes in America dealing with divorce? Well, that is also a temptation for leaders is to minimize trauma and in their own lives, and that is part of the problem of overcoming it, keeping it, and that's when Tara uses the word hiding. She meant it's really running from pain or burying it as if it's possible to do that, escaping from it, overcoming it, and culture and church culture even still celebrates that, but actually we got to go back and look into how events and experiences, and for me that was part of it. There were other things that took place too, but the ambivalence is really kind of a symptom almost in of itself, something that gives you a chance to kind of like scratch a little bit and get the old sniffer out to try to discern what is there behind this feeling I'm having in my experiences. And that led me to that curiosity, which I felt it also was impacting how, you know, the clarity I sought and my ability to lead early on in life. It led me to go get help and to go and seek counsel. And that was a big part of it. So I think that's one thing. Tara, what's another thought?
Yeah, I would say that oftentimes we ignore, as Jeff was saying, those of us that have any sort of pain, nobody likes to feel it. And so if we find ourselves dismissing our own pain or the pain of others, minimizing things, I would say we literally ignore our bodies, and we can start to see symptoms happening as leaders start to feel more anxiety, intensity, possibly actual physical ailments like stomach, heart pain. And there's this intensity that starts to build over time just in leadership itself. Leadership can be traumatic. There's so many stressors and confidentiality and decision-making. And so how are we handling our stress? That's also a cue of how we resolved our trauma. Have we dealt with our pain in healthy ways? Or are we just going for quick fixes? And some of those quick fixes might start small. I have a glass of wine every night just to calm down. And all of a sudden, I find myself now I'm way down the line and really struggling with not going through life without alcohol. So not that every leader is struggling with some sort of substance abuse, but there is all kinds of isms, right? Workaholism. We can even use good things like just being too busy with church ministries to avoid our own emotional pain and the emotional pain of others.
Your book is divided into two parts. The first is Understanding Leadership and Integrity Gaps, and the second part, the symptoms of integrity that are all too familiar to many of us, either as leaders or as those who have been led. The guilt and toxic shame, if they only knew, escapism and compartmentalization, which I think you mentioned earlier, narcissism, arrogance. Understanding Leadership, is that part of the book for those who are in positions of leadership to really examine their leadership style and their understanding of what it means to lead others, whether that's in the formal sense or in more of a casual sense where you are a person of influence and you're leading essentially by default?
Well, we would just say both. We would say anybody that's leading anyone, even if you have a following, you're a leader, and boy, the cost, and I'd say the impact, it grows as influence, power, and authority and role increases. And this is for people that are, share our biblical worldview, are Christians, identify themselves as followers of Jesus, and those that don't yet. I mean, we make an argument, not trying to shove anything down anyone's throat, but to make an argument for a biblical worldview about leadership and really calling out, I think, the trouble that exists within the church, capital C and local C, that needs to be addressed. We don't want to see the headlines of failed leadership and of many of these symptoms that were emerged that then created harm. Jesus is able certainly to hold his own reputation. He doesn't need any of our help, but he does want us to be like him and to grow in likeness. And this is this happens as we are attuned to the vulnerabilities that we have as humans, but particularly in leadership, to these symptoms and practical antidotes as to how to see them ahead of time, or if you're in them, how to get back, if you will. And if you've been there and done that, and you can say, gosh, chapters 3, 6, and 9 were my life, you're in a mentoring relationship with someone else that you could just say, let me share with you how real this got for me. And working together in mentoring relationships is a huge part of shrinking a gap environmentally and culturally. We need more and more mentors that don't feel like they had to be perfect, but are willing to turn back and to be honest, authentic, having closed their gaps significantly and be able to help others now.
I so appreciate your mentioning that the goal isn't perfection, because we're never going to reach that even if we aspire to it, but just to be a person of integrity. Now, two of the symptoms of integrity gaps that you mentioned are narcissism and his first cousin, arrogance, which has been elevated to some degree in our culture to a virtue. Can you speak to both of those and how they express themselves in leadership and why we need to aspire to tone it down, for lack of a better way of putting it?
I love that. Tone it down. Let's tone it down. Well, we would say, and it's so humbling to have to say it because all three of us here are leaders, right, with a title, but narcissism is a continuum, and we all have a temptation to fall a little bit along that continuum. And the awareness the person who's listening and is like, am I a narcissist? No. If you think you're a narcissist, you're not a narcissist. Because narcissists would never think that of themselves. But there is something called narcissistic personality disorder, the NPD, and that is a diagnosis of somebody who lacks empathy, has grandiose thinking about themselves, and has really lost touch with reality and sobriety of who they are and their impact on others. And often these narcissists, the NPDs, are the abusers and predators in our communities. They're really the ones that we're shocked by because they're often charismatic and well-loved and liked. That's how they earn trust. And they really use our Christian theology of grace and forgiveness against their victims. So we really are trying to educate and helping the greater community to say, let's not progress. Let's keep an eye on what a true NPD looks like and not be smoothed by them before they've got access to too many sheep and they're doing harm in harm's way. The Bible calls them, you know, the wolves in sheep's clothing, mm-hmm. and they are rampant. And then the arrogance, the cousin or the is definitely a piece of that narcissism, but that arrogance is just that human part of all of us that says our way is the better way, whether that's culturally, wiring, gender, whatever that is, where we think our perspective on the world is the way. And so learning how to be a leader who actually takes in the community, that we're better together, and what does that really look like from a wholehearted leadership perspective.
Another area that you cover are blind spots. And I think that's kind of a terrifying area, because if you are unaware of a blind spot, you're not likely to address it. So you draw our attention to those areas that we may not be aware of. And your subtitle is Too Little Time to Listen. And that is such a temptation for those who are in positions of influence and leadership. They're busy serving, and therefore they don't really have time to listen to those who might warn us of those blind spots that undermine our leadership capacity and our integrity. Can you talk a little bit about those blind spots? And obviously your book draws our attention to them, but that's a real challenge for many leaders.
Oh, it is, Georgine. And we would just say we're advocates for leaders to have at least one or two key relationships outside their organizational structure where they are not accountable to these people in terms of, like, their livelihoods aren't attached to them. And the leader is subject to be influenced by them, right? Why is that so important? Well, it allows the leader to be human and to be able to talk about what's going well and what's not without the concerns that many of them as leaders are holding in organizational and business settings, what have you. They need the freedom to be able to be known and to be influenced by others. And of course, you want to pick people, if you will, that are wise, that are for you and care for you and are going to be able to speak truth into your life, right, in a graceful way. And that's just hard to find, and that's why it's so rare, and leaders don't spend the time finding that or subjecting themselves to it because of the tyranny of the urgent. Mm-hmm. And the temptations, of course, to the other symptoms, right? If they think that it's just better if they do it, which is a common lie that many leaders believe, they're going to likely fall into the trap of taking too much on, which could lead to burnout and so on and so forth, right? Isolating as well. I mean, if you isolate anything, it's likely dying. If you look at creation when that takes place and isolate lion prides, isolate the young and the elderly and the sick, right? And that's how they pick off their prey. Isolation is not an aspect of God's design for human flourishing.
We're talking with Jeff and Tara Mattson. Their latest book, Shrinking the Integrity Gap Between What Leaders Preach and Live. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show, and we're continuing our conversation with Tara and Jeff Mattson, their book, Shrinking the Integrity Gap Between What Leaders Preach and Live. It's not a how-to book in terms of how to be a better leader, but really goes to the root of what it means to be a leader and what's at the core of one's being. Now, one of the areas that you write about is burnout, and I think for some in leadership, that's almost a badge of honor. If I'm burnt out, that's evidence of my complete commitment. But it also says, as you point out here, it's easier for me to just do it myself, that you're choosing to to lead without the support and the help of others. And I suppose it's related to some degree to this notion that, you know, I'm really better than everyone else, and therefore I should just do it myself because no one else can meet my standards. Can you talk about burnout that is so common these days and often is linked with what we see in terms of leadership's leaders falling?
Oh, it's so good. It is actually our lack of trust in God and each other. And it's too much trust put into our own abilities. And I am guilty of this. I'll just confess all the radio. I mean, I'm guilty of it. And I wouldn't say it comes from a lot of people's perspective. I would say it probably doesn't come from that place of I'm better than. It's more of a posture of I think I'm trying to help everybody. And it's a savior complex in a way. And again, it can be a badge of honor, especially in the church and thinking and leader types who are like type A and driven and if I can get it done better. So that posture of being able to know our limits, do we know our wiring? Do we know our story? Do we know when we're getting overwhelmed? Can we tell when our body is giving us signals? Right now, everybody is facing burnout with just our global trauma that we're all holding. And being able to say no, using our boundaries, all of those are skill sets that often we don't put into practice until it's too late. And we're just calling for, we want healthier leaders who can finish the race well and aren't sprinting halfway through and then are knocked out the rest of the race.
Mm-hmm. One of the recent guests on our podcast indicated it in their journey that led towards depression and burnout, that literally God had to remove all of their options for them. And that's sometimes what it takes. It doesn't have to go that direction, but that's sometimes what it takes for a person to realize that that they're tapped, you know, and that they need help. And we would just advocate for, like Tara was saying, attuning to what's going on. The body keeps the score. It's communicating, and high-capacity leaders, male or female, you know, may be really good at ignoring their body signs, right? So where do you hold anxiety? You know, that was a big learning curve in my own journey. Well, I clenched my jaw and I cracked my knuckles. I didn't even know I did that until probably 10 years into our marriage. And that was a starting point to pay attention to, you know, God speaking into through my body and to the Holy Spirit that my reservoirs, my margin was tapping, and gosh, I could press through that and call myself, a better leader or someone who's overcome obstacles. But you can't give what you don't have. And when you're tapped, it may be too late in terms of, time that could have been spent more wisely or in help, in reading, and learning and growing and preparing for, preventing some of the things that burnout brings.
We're talking about the second part of the book, Shrinking the Integrity Gap, which is not just a book, it's more of a movement, but symptoms of the integrity gap. And one of those symptoms is that survival mode that you just made reference to, that by admitting that we have needs, we believe that's a sign of weakness, and therefore we never allow anyone to know that we might be struggling physically or in other ways, because we see that as a sign of weakness, when in fact God has designed us in order that we might be alerted to the challenges that we're facing and the approach that we're taking that might not be healthy for us. Can you talk a bit about survival, that mode for the leader who doesn't want to admit it because others might lose confidence?
Oh, so good. And it's actually far too common. I will go back all the way to a lot of our family of origins. We learn about needs and how to meet those needs in the families we grow up in. And often, high-capacity leaders are caretakers of others, their oldest siblings, or they had a lot of trauma in their stories, and so they were the ones who were able to handle taking on the extra load. We're used to high intensity and solving problems and being the one that everybody comes to. And so fast forward all those years, there's no time to be weak. There's no time to be vulnerable. And in abusive homes, vulnerabilities are taken advantage of, right? If you show your weakness, you're going to get consequences. So we learn really quickly not to expose that. And we're really wanting to see a culture where we can say, help. I'm hurting. I feel uncomfortable with this situation, and to be heard and to be honored and it not to be seen as weak. Because from a biblical worldview, we see that very different. We think like the foundation of our faith, right, is saying, help, I need a savior. I can't do this by myself. And yet somewhere along the way, us leaders think we're exempt from that. And it's not a conscious way of being, but we've just walked with so many leaders who literally can't identify a need they have. They can identify everybody else's needs, the needs of the organization, the needs of their spouse, the needs of their kids, the needs of their friends. But if I ask them, what do you need right now? They're just numb to that. They're so used to pushing past their own humanity for the sake of helping solve problems in the world.
One of the things I so appreciate about your book, Shrinking the Integrity Gap Between What Leaders Preach and Live, is it's so practical, it's refreshing, and it helps us to recognize those areas where we might be struggling and God wants to liberate us. And in walking according to the leadership pattern that he has, we can have so much greater influence over others who might be struggling in the same areas. I want to get to one final chapter before asking how this book is best applied to those in positions of leadership or those who are being led. But I wanted to talk about your chapter on hiding, those areas where, you know, there's real struggle there and confession costs too much. So we just hold them in order to maintain the facade that, you know, there's nothing to see here.
Yeah, you know, this is just a sad truth and a reality that as other symptoms that we've mentioned, they feeds into this, right? As a person gets deeper, and every person is vulnerable to this. Every human is vulnerable to this. As we get deeper into maladaptive coping strategies, things that we use to get our needs met in unhealthy ways, that depending on how acceptable or not acceptable from a societal standpoint is the behavior is, we may hide, we may conceal it, we may say that we even and begin to start believing that we deserve this. And you hear leaders talking about deserving or needing certain outlets. And even in the church, unfortunately, in not so long ago, saying things like, well-known celebrity leaders saying things like, God was okay with this behavior, and directly in contradiction to behaviors that God would ever sanction or be okay with, right? But that's the level of deception that can take place in a person's heart and mind. And as hiding takes place, we're vulnerable as humans, and leaders also very vulnerable because the pressure is on, right, to keep up appearances of what might be acceptable and what might not be. And we get deeper and deeper lost into that darkness. And the cost then, always before us, of being exposed or found out grows. And that fear factor of not being caught or exposed or it being discovered increases. So it's additive. It snowballs, Georgine. Tara, what else are you thinking about that?
Well, I was just thinking about the cost of sin. And there's always a consequence. And we are just... none of us fall short, or all of us fall short, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're all struggling, but it's the pattern. It's the pattern of hiding. It's the pattern of not being honest and trusting another human being and our God with all of who we are. And so that gap gets wider, the consequences get greater, and it's super hard for high-capacity leaders because there's not just, they are not just impacted, it's everybody else in their wake, and those are those headlines that we see. We all start to struggle and lose trust. And so there's a difference between a Saul heart and a David heart, and the David heart, both of them struggled as leaders, but the David heart is willing to face the consequences and not manage them. And I think that's just our bottom line is, at some point, our hidden life is going to be found out. And so take the higher road in terms of confession and then face the consequences. And we know that it's hard. And the longer we hide, the harder it gets. So let's do it sooner.
What's the best way for...
The freedom also that comes from that is significant. And it's, yeah, we'd say, as hard as it is, you know, and looking at David, yeah, he faced the consequences, but the freedom that comes from God coming in, who sees it all anyway, and walking beside us, and with grace, thank God for grace, being able to take the shame that is not from him out of the equation. We aren't what we do. We are his, as his kids, if we know him and trust Christ in our lives. And And he can help us and set us free from the things that, like the toxic shame that we and the devil loves to pile on a person and to try to steal, kill, and destroy him, which is outlined in the scriptures. Thanks to God for his amazing grace and that he is able to help us overcome any obstacles in our, whatever size our integrity gap is, but it only comes through confession and repentance, a turning away and a clinging to him and his help. And that's where the journey of integrity can begin again for someone who's lost their way. And so we want to make sure that we bring the hope into this picture. This isn't about pointing fingers. It's about saying, look at God's design. It's incredible. And he is still the answer.
Yes, yes. We're out of time, but I want to ask you just quickly, what's the best way to approach the book? As an individual reading the book in a small group, in an accountability, with an accountability partner, how do you recommend this is best applied to the heart of a leader or those who are being led?
We love the idea of somebody reading this with one other person at least. It can come alongside an organizational team, a mentor and a mentee, but being able to actually move through these chapters with someone else to have that more awareness dialogue. And then it's a book that's meant to be something that we look at continually and to be able to process along the way throughout our life. Time of leadership. So don't put it back on your shelf. It's meant to be a tool. And then whoever God has in your life of influence, you can read along with them or just be focusing on certain chapters. So thank you for asking that question.
Well, Tara and Jeff, thank you so much for your time with us. I want to encourage our listeners to pick up a copy of Shrinking the Integrity Gap Between What Leaders Preach and Live. And again, it doesn't just apply to those who have titles after their names or microphones in their hands, but to all of us who have influence, great or small, we can benefit from this this book. Thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Georgine.
Thanks for having us.
Always a pleasure. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back in just a few moments.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back to wrap things up. Went a little long on all three segments, but it was absolutely worth it. I love Tara and Jeff Mattson, and hope you appreciated what they had to share. Tomorrow on the program, of course, we hope to have some answers about the election, maybe not at the top of the ticket, but some of the down ballot issues and candidates. We'll cover that for you during the program tomorrow. Also, depending on how things turn out, we may talk with Stacey Thacker. She's the author of Threadbare Prayer, Prayers for Hearts That Feel Hidden, Hurt, or Hopeless. Might be a timely subject given all that's going on in our culture and our country right now. Hope you're spending some time on your knees for the outcome of this election, for the unity of the church and the future of the republic, and that we can come together in some semblance that is honoring to God for those of us who are followers of Jesus. I want to thank James Blinn, Clark Hilton, and Dan Rice, and thank you for making The Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.